Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Joining us on the line, we have the one and only Robert Rann talking about his Menendez Murders book. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
I'd like to know how you got so involved in this.
Well, in August of 1989, I was a freelance writer working for the Sunday Magazine and the Miami Herald, Tropic Magazine, and I had an assignment to go out to Las Vegas and research and report a story about the home video business. In the 1980s, the home video business was taking off. Home video actually began in the late 70s, and it was all porn. But by the early 80s, the mainstream studios said, wait a minute, we can release our movies and create a whole new income stream, and it became an enormous income stream for the studios. And so by the late 80s, there was an annual trade show called the Video Software Dealers Convention in Vegas. And a third of the convention was still porn, but two-thirds of the convention was the mainstream studios. And they would bring their, you know, their biggest stars, Sylvester Stallone, Julia Roberts. They would throw parties, elaborate parties. I mean, it was a four-day blowout. And mom-and-pop retailers, you know, who were a significant percentage of the business back then, would come to Vegas, and so, along with, Blockbuster, make it a Blockbuster night. So in the 1980s, all the major studios quickly opened up home video divisions, and eventually the independent studios did the same thing. Carol Cole Pictures was one of the most successful independent studios in the 80s. They released the Rambo movies. They released a movie called Basic Instinct with Sharon Stone that many people are familiar with. So in August of 89, early August, I'm in Vegas, and I'm, you know, doing, you know, talking to all kinds of people in the home video business. And I had a friend who was editor of a trade magazine. He's taking me around and introducing me to people. And I come back to Miami, and 10 days later, I get a phone call at 10 in the morning on a Monday morning from my friend who says, you know, there's a high-profile guy in the home video business. He and his wife were blown away last night in Beverly Hills. And okay, that caught my attention. And he was Cuban American, which made it a potential interest to people in Miami. And in the one general fact that a lot of people don't realize is there were 7 months between the killing of Jose and Kitty Menendez and the arrest of their sons, Lyle and Eric Menendez. And In the first few days after the deaths of Jose and Kitty, the Menendez murders were really only on the national media radar for maybe 3 or 4 days. In that first week, the Wall Street Journal ran a front page story, and the headline was Hints of Mob Rub-Up. And the LA Times was also running stories about, they were quoting unnamed sources in the LA County Sheriff's Office saying, these murders, we believe that this was sometimes something related to organized crime. And there was a legitimate reason why people were speculating that, which was that the home video business, as I just mentioned a minute ago, the origins were in adult film. And a lot of those early home video people had alleged connections to the mafia. So Jose Menendez was hired by Caracol Pictures to open a home video division, and they bought a company called IVE and renamed it Live Entertainment. And Menendez's assignment was to, create a successful company out of IVE, which had been kind of a B-movie distributor, and they also had softcore porn. And Menendez had a very violent, I shouldn't use the word violent. He had a very strong disagreement with a man named Noel Blue, who had been the owner and CEO of IVE. And when Menendez took over, they basically pushed Noel Blue out, and there was some serious animosity and a lot of legal wrangling going on for a settlement. And so Noel Blue was actually one of the early suspects in the media. Now, he was never a suspect in the Beverly Hills Police, but anyway, that's more information than you needed to know about how I got into the story. I just spent a couple months researching the home video business, and all of a sudden the media is saying, this lovely couple is killed in Beverly Hills, and, the media speculation, LA Times, Wall Street Journal, mainstream media, saying, it might be mob related. And so I, kind of dove into that, and within about 10 days I found out that Jose Menendez had a sister named Marta Cano who lived in West Palm Beach, Florida. And 1989, before the internet or cell phones, I got out the West Palm Beach phone book in the newsroom at the Miami Herald. I found Marta Cano's home number. She was listed. I called her up, 5% to make a condolence call, 95% to hit on her for a story. She immediately invited me up to West Palm Beach, and we spent 4 hours talking about the family history. This is about 2 weeks after the murders. And the family history was the family started in Spain with nothing, became wealthy, lost everything, immigrated to Cuba with nothing, became wealthy. Castro came in, they lost everything again. And then the family came to the States with nothing. And Jose Menendez became head of Hertz, head of RCA Records, and eventually, after 20 years living in Princeton and working in New York, the family moved to California in 1987, and he became head of a home video company. So I was kind of in on the ground floor of the story, literally, because I went back to Miami after I met with Eric and Lyle Menendez's aunt, Marcia Cano. And I said to my editor at the Sunday Magazine, look, we don't know anything about this murder investigation. The Beverly Hills Police aren't talking. But I said, this family has a really interesting story. So why don't I do a biography about Jose Menendez, rags to riches, Cuban-American story ends, immigrant's dream story ends in this terrible tragedy. So my original assignment was to write a biography. As part of that reporting, I came out to California in October of 89, 2 months after the murders, 5 months before the brothers were arrested, and I spent 3 days with Eric and Lyle Menendez. And the purpose of our interview was to talk about their father for my biography, and they told me very loving, caring stories about how much they loved their parents, how much they missed their parents, how I get into the story, but that's it.
Wow.
No, that's it. I was just, when you talked to Eric and Lyle, and they were giving you loving stories. Did they tell you who they thought killed their parents?
No. Well, as I just said, my assignment was to write a biography about Jose Menendez. So I really wasn't trying to, you know, push them about the investigation. But at one time, the first day of the formal interviews, Lyle Menendez, I was with both brothers, Lyle Menendez asked me to, I pulled out a tape recorder and a notepad, and he asked me not to take notes or record them. He said, we want to just get to know you. And in fact, about 15 minutes after meeting them, he said to me, we're thinking about writing a book about our father. He was such a great man. Would you be interested in working with us? So that was kind of an odd moment. And we continued. On that first day, we were just kind of talking in general about 90% of the conversation was focused on their father and what a great man he was. And they were telling me how he wanted to liberate Cuba and that he wanted to actually had a 5-year plan, which the Jose's sister, Marta, told me about, in which his plan was to leave the entertainment business in 5 years, move to Miami, run for the U.S. Senate. And his goal was to liberate Cuba from Castro. So the second day of the interview, Lyle had left on a red eye at midnight the night before because he had to go to New York where he had bought a chicken wing restaurant in Princeton. And so I was alone with Eric. And when Eric had been together with Lyle, Lyle was doing 90% of the talking. And when Eric would talk, I noticed that he was kind of looking over at Lyle as if, am I doing okay? And when I was with Eric alone the second day, Eric's personality was 180 degrees different. And he was, you know, telling really loving anecdotes. He was emotional, appropriately emotional. And so at one point about 2 hours into the 3.5 hour that I recorded the interview I did that day, I said to him, look, I'm not doing a story about the murder case, but I just want to ask you a few questions about, you know, the night you came home and found your parents. And so Eric did answer a few questions. At one point, he said to me, and here's a quote, he said, I think that possibly if Lyle and I would have been at home, if we would have been able to do something about it, maybe my dad would be alive. Maybe I'd be dead. You know, I mean, I don't know. I wish I definitely would give my life for my dad's. So, you know, it's a pretty interesting moment, quotes to me. And I was using a 1990s audio cassette recorder. And right at that, we had talked about 10 minutes about the night of the murders. And right at that point, the tape ran out on my audio cassette player. And Eric was kind of misty-eyed, and he said to me, can we stop talking about this? This is really difficult. And, you know, I'm a compassionate journalist. And so I said, yeah, don't worry about it. But that 10 minutes is a really interesting piece of, you know, is a really interesting interview, which I, of course, go into in the book.
Yeah. What was your feeling on the two of them? As in their interactions when they were together, and did you feel did you have any intuition at all that they might have been part of it or any sort of feelings?
No, I had absolutely no reason to be suspicious of them. The brothers were not suspects publicly in October of '89. I later found out that actually the Beverly Hills police received a phone call from a lawyer about 10 days after the killing of Jose and Kitty. And the lawyer was calling on behalf of the mother of one of of Eric Menendez's friends from Calabasas High, where he had gone the year before the family moved to Beverly Hills. In fact, one interesting factoid is that the Menendezes had only lived in Beverly Hills for about 8 months. They'd been living in Calabasas, which nobody knew what Calabasas was back then, and now we all know about the Kardashians. But if the murders had happened 8 months earlier, it would have been the Calabasas murders, and that doesn't quite have the same ring as my cover story on People magazine in March of 1990, Murder in Beverly Hills. So the Beverly Hills police got a tip from a lawyer who said, you should look at the brothers. And they were looking at the brothers within 10 or 12 days. But none of that was public. So fast forward to December of 89. It was 2 days before my deadline for the Miami Herald magazine story about a 6,000-word feature biography. And the brother's aunt, Marta Cano, had given me the famous family portrait, the four-shot that's been in the media a lot. The two brothers are standing, the two parents are sitting. And she called me up late one afternoon and said, you can't use the picture. The brothers were coming out of a bank in Beverly Hills this morning, and somebody walked past them and said, you're next. And, you know, that kind of got my attention. So I hung up with her, and I immediately called Les Oler, the lead detective at Beverly Hills Police, and I said, tell me about the death threats the brothers got this morning. And he said to me, what death threats? And I just, you know, I told him, I said, well, I assume, you know, I just found out, you know, from their aunt that they were coming out of the bank. Somebody said, you're next. You would assume if your parents are brutally murdered and you get death threats, I think I'd go running to the police station. So they had not. And 2 minutes later, or about 5 minutes later, the aunt called me and was yelling at me and said, why did you call the Beverly Hills police? The brothers did not want them to know about the death threats. And I hung up with her, and I went into my editor's office, Tom Schroeder, and I said, wow, this feels a little weird. And he turned to me, and he said, they did it. And I said, no, I don't think so. Again, this is December of 89, the arrest in March of 90. I said, I don't think so. You know, I spent time with them, talked to the relatives, but, you know, because Tom Schroeder said they did it, I called Les Oler back at the Beverly Hills Police Station and started asking some direct questions. And he, of course, would not tell me anything. But between the lines of what he was saying, it was very clear to me that the brothers were the primary suspects. And I, you know, had at this point in December of 89, I already knew that it had nothing to do with the home video business, but I really had no definite theory on, you know, who the suspects might be. So at the last minute, the day before my article was published, we added two or three paragraphs about that the Beverly Hills police are even looking at the brothers as potential suspects, and it was the first media speculation in any mainstream media that the brothers were under suspicion.
That must have lost your trust with the brothers right away then.
No.
No,
actually not, because along with, you know, a little information about, you know that the Beverly Hills police have not, you know, eliminated them as suspects, I had some quotes from their aunt in which she said, you know, we're aware that the Beverly Hills police are, you know, looking at them, but there's no way that they were involved in this, and the family fully supports them. So, you know, like a good journalist, I had both sides of the story. I had the police speculation, and I had the family reaction. And so what happened was, after I interviewed the brothers in October of 89, actually 9 days after my interview with Eric Menendez, when he's telling me loving, compassionate stories about his parents for 3.5 hours, 9 days after that interview, he went to the therapist, Dr. Jerome Oziel, and confessed the murders. And I always wondered, what impact did that have on him, you know, spending 3.5 hours with a reporter, putting on a facade.
Yeah. Now, that's a really interesting part of the case, is the therapist and the relationship that he had with the therapist as well as the girlfriend. Like, that was a pretty weird setup, wasn't it?
Well, the story of Dr. Jerome Oziel and his girlfriend, mistress, paramour, whatever you'd like to, whatever word you'd like to use to describe her, could be a book in itself. Dr. Jerome Oziel was a Beverly Hills psychologist. Dr. Oziel was married to another therapist, his wife Laurel. They were in practice together. And in the summer of 89, a couple months before Jose and Kitty Menendez are killed, Dr. Oziel begins a romantic relationship with a woman named Judalon Smith. And so their relationship is, you know, kind of playing out over the next few months. And it's kind of in the background of you know, the Menendez brothers story. And on the night that Eric Menendez confessed to Dr. Ozeal, it was Halloween 1989, there's several different versions of what happened that night. There's Dr. Ozeal's version, there is Jude Lon Smith's version, and Eric and Lyle Menendez each have their own version, which they testified about, and I've talked to them since then. And according to Dr. Ozeal, Eric Menendez came into his office and was, you know, very distraught and upset, and they went on a walk, you know, to a park a few blocks away in Beverly Hills, and as they were coming back to his office, Eric paused just outside the office building, leaned against a parking meter, and told Dr. Ozeal, "We did it." So then they went back upstairs, and Dr. Ozeal got him talking, and within about half an hour, Dr. Ozeal said, "We need to call your brother Lyle right away." Lyle Menendez was at the Menendez mansion on North Elm Drive, passing out Halloween candy with his girlfriend, and Dr. Ozeal called him and said, "We need you to come over here right away." And, you know, and Lyle Menendez says, "What's this about?" And Dr. Ozeal said, "Well, Eric has told me everything." And Lyle Menendez was, you know, totally freaked out, raced over in his brand new Porsche to Dr. Ozeal's office, and he was very angry with Eric, you know, very upset in general, because, you know, suddenly somebody knew that they were responsible for their parents' deaths. And so they stayed and talked for about half an hour, 45 minutes, and then Lyle said, "I'm done. You know, I'm leaving," and he grabbed Eric, and they went to the elevator. And Dr. Ozeal was trying to get them to come back to his office, because he thought this was a very volatile situation. He didn't want them to leave. He, you know, thought, you know, they needed to continue talking to just kind of cool down everything. And as he was getting on the elevator, Lyle Menendez turned to Dr. Ozeal. This is according to Dr. Ozeal, and said, "Good luck, Dr. Ozeal." Shook his hand, looked him in the eye, and Dr. Ozeal interpreted that as he was going to need some good luck. And the brothers left, and this is where the story gets a little murky. Jude Lon Smith, Dr. Ozeal's girlfriend, claims that she was in the waiting room on the night that the Menendez brothers were in the office. And she also claimed that she could hear their confession from down the hall. Now, that never happened. I'm not even sure if she was in the office that night. That was her story when she was doing a lot of media just after the arrest, when she was on Primetime Live with Diane Sawyer on ABC. She did an interview with, you know, several interviews with Dominic Dunn for Vanity Fair, and, you know, spun this whole story. And in the early months after the arrest, you know, she was potentially a really important character, because if she actually overheard their convention, she was an extremely important potential prosecution witness. But I'm not sure she was really there. Anyway, that, as I say, that's a whole other crazy story. And just one short other fact is that after the confession, Dr. Ozeal, I believe, just gossiped with his girlfriend, told her about the confession, and then their relationship starts to go sour, and Jude Lon Smith started threatening to go to the Beverly Hills police and tell them that the brothers had confessed. And then at one point in December of 89, Dr. Ozeal records an hour-long therapy tape and tells the brothers, "Look, if you ever get arrested, this tape will show that you had remorse." And so at that point, the Menendez and Anderson family members believe that Dr. Ozeal was blackmailing the brothers, because he scheduled 5 appointments a week for each of them. And according to testimony that was in the trial, the first trial, said to them, "I don't care if you ever show up for these therapy sessions, that I'm going to bill your family for them." And the brothers certainly interpreted that as, you know, these are just, you know, therapy sessions on the books. I don't care if you show up, but I'll be billing your family for 2 sessions a day, 5 days a week. So At one point, Dr. Oziel, so now that Dr. Oziel's personal life is spinning even further out of control, because Judilyn Smith is aware of all this, and she's really making serious threats to go to the Beverly Hills Police. So Dr. Oziel and his wife Laurel, another therapist, moved Judilyn Smith into their house with their 8 and 10-year-old daughter in an effort to keep the lid on her. Kind of a strange situation. These two therapists, their own personal lives were really spinning out of control. Fast forward to March of 1990, there was an incident one day where they came home and apparently, according to Dr. Oziel's testimony, was talking to his daughters and telling them, "I'm going to be your new mommy. Your mommy's moving out." So they kicked her out. The next day, Judilyn Smith goes to the Beverly Hills Police. The day after that, Lyle Menendez is arrested.
But how could they use her testimony, as it's pretty secondhand?
Well, parts of it are secondhand. That's why I said just a moment ago that in the early days of after the arrest, she appeared to be, Dr. Oziel was obviously would be the star prosecution witness, and Judilyn Smith was certainly a close number two, if she had actually overheard their confession. As I said, I don't believe she ever overheard anything, because when I did I was working on a story for Playboy, a very long 14,000 word story. They told me it was the longest article Playboy ever ran, because Hef was really into the story. And I interviewed Dr. Oziel, his first national media interview, for that article, which was published in March of 91. And Dr. Oziel could not talk about the case, because the case was, still pending. It was about 2 years away from trial. But Judilyn Smith had been all over the media bashing Dr. Oziel. So Dr. Oziel went out and hired a publicist to screen reporters, and I was the guy who got the brass ring. And that was Dr. Oziel's first national media interview. So he couldn't talk about the brothers, couldn't talk about the case, but he wanted to bash Judilyn Smith as she had been bashing him. So that's why their whole story is just, spinning off into a crazy side story of that intersected with this high-profile murder case. They're two very interesting characters.
I was going to say. Now, when they were in jail, too, I guess.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The whole OJ thing was happening, and Eric actually knew OJ in jail, didn't he?
Yes. Well. Actually, both brothers, this is 6 degrees of separation. This is, you know, such a classic L.A. thing. Actually, it happens everywhere in high-profile cases. When Eric and Lyle Menendez were young boys, Jose Menendez was head of Hertz Rent-A-Car. And you might remember, if you're old enough, that O.J. Simpson was doing TV commercials for Hertz. I think it was in the... late 70s, early 80s, in which he was running through airports and jumping over suitcases. And it was a, you know, classic, commercial that was in heavy rotation. And so, OJ actually came to the Menendez home in Princeton one night for dinner. And he met Eric and Lyle Menendez when they were little kids.
Wow.
So, fast forward to June of 94, OJ, is in the Bronco, riding around L.A. with the helicopter chasing him on live TV. And about 6 or 7 o'clock, the, sheriff's deputies in the jail pulled Eric out of his cell. And Eric was in, both brothers were isolated from the general population because they were high profile prisoners. And the reason they isolate celebrities or high profile prisoners is that somebody might just want to stab you, you know, and try to become famous themselves. So both brothers were isolated in separate areas of the jail. So Eric is in what's called a pod with about 6 or 8 cells. The sheriff's deputies pull him out of the cell about 6 or 7 o'clock at night on the Friday night of the Bronco chase. They hand him a mop and say, clean up this pod. And Eric had a TV, and so he was watching the Bronco chase. And when they pulled him out and handed him the mop, Eric had a moment in which he said, "Well, I wonder if they're about to bring OJ into my neighborhood of cells." And about 10:30 that night, he heard the crowd of deputies coming down the hall, and O.J. Simpson walked by his cell in handcuffs, and they placed O.J. in the cell right next to Eric Menendez. Now, O.J. Simpson, if people can remember before, he was O.J. Simpson, the killer. O.J. Simpson was a beloved football player. He had been an actor in, a couple of Naked Gun movies. He was a football commentator. Everybody loved O.J. back in the days before the, long before the murders. O.J. was used to being, kind of buddies with everybody and friendly. And that first night he was doing a lot of talking with the sheriff's deputies. And after, the deputies basically went away for the night, Eric Menendez started whispering to O.J. and telling him, "You cannot talk to these deputies. These guys are not your friends. You know, they may be wearing recording devices. Anything you tell them, they're going to report to the prosecutors and the investigators." And so what a bizarre situation in that Eric Menendez is giving O.J. Simpson advice on how to survive in jail.
I wonder if they talked about the ham dinner that they had back in the day. Well, they probably did talk about recognizing each other, I'm sure.
Well, my memory is that Eric did tell me that he mentioned something that he had met O.J. before. And OJ probably didn't remember, but I don't know that for a fact. I'll have to give OJ a call next week.
Yeah, he's out looking for the killers on the golf course.
Right. Well, funny you mentioned that. I was just a couple weeks ago. I just happened to take a look at about an hour after the OJ verdict was announced, which was October 2nd. I think it was October 2nd or 3rd, 1995. OJ's son Jason, along with his mother and sister and some other family members, were having a news conference in the courtroom where the trial had taken place, where the verdict was announced. And Jason Simpson read a statement from OJ in which he said, you know, my father is going to devote his life to looking for the real killer. And I just stumbled across it a couple weeks ago, and that was kind of fascinating too. You know, because I knew in the back of my head, but to actually see the video is kind of fascinating. But right, the inner, you know, 6 degrees of separation, Eric and Lyle, I'm sorry, Eric and OJ are in cells next to each other, and you know, Eric, they couldn't actually see each other because their cells are right next to each other, but they could kind of whisper that, you know, between each other, and sometimes they would pass letters back and forth when one or the other was being taken you know, to the showers.
Oh, maybe someone dropped the soap.
Oh, well. No.
Bada boom.
Oh, no. Yeah, Al, be quiet. Well, no, okay, so now one of the biggest things in this, the whole case, the first one in the second trial, was about the sexual abuse. And they used a lot of that in the first trial, and they didn't in the second, and they weren't able to. You have brought up a letter that happened between Eric's cousin and I believe Andy Cano and himself mentioning the abuse that, you know, before the murder. So now you say that was never used in the trial. So how did it come out, and how did you get it?
Let me just say a couple things quickly in general. The first minute of this trial was a media sensation. It was carried live on a brand new cable channel called Court TV, gavel to gavel, all day from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and then Court TV ran a three-hour highlight show at night called Primetime Justice. So people in the U.S. and all over the world were following this trial like a novella. The general public was kind of stuck on, well, first of all, the mainstream media adopted or signed on to a log line on the trial, Greedy Rich Kids Kill Ozzie and Harriet on a Sunday night in Beverly Hills. Now, there were 3 years between the trial and the rest of the brothers in the trial, because there was an issue with the therapist who had, you know, recorded this audio tape confession with the brothers, and also had other information. And normally, you have a privilege with your therapist, in which whatever you tell that therapist is privilege. There's one exception to the privilege, which is if you threaten your therapist, or if you tell your therapist, I'm going to kill my girlfriend or boyfriend tomorrow, the therapist is obligated to go to law enforcement and to tell people that might be in danger. So the general public was kind of caught up in and the defense made, so for 3 years, the only story the public heard was the PR people from the LA County DA's office putting out the spin, Greedy Rich Kids Kill Ozzie and Harriet. And the job of those PR people at the DA's office is to poison the potential jury pool and in a high-profile trial. And, you know, sorry to say that, but that's what they do. So the general public, that was the only story they heard for 3 years. And 2 weeks before the trial, the defense went public and said, you know, no, we have a completely different story. This is a story of intergenerational sexual abuse, and the brothers were, we have eyewitnesses to physical, verbal, and emotional abuse. The brothers are going to tell you about how they were sexually molested. And the general public was hung up on the idea of, the general public thought this trial was, we were sexually molested, so therefore we get a free pass to kill mom and dad. And that was not the defense. But that was the image that the general public had. So now to get back to this letter that was one of my scoops in the book, I did not see this letter, for the complete letter, until March of 2018, a few months before the final deadline of my book. The first Menendez trial was 93-94. Second Menendez trial was 95-96. First trial ended in two hung juries, a mistrial. Then they were retried, and the judge reversed most of his evidence rulings. The second trial jury heard a completely different set of evidence. The defense was not allowed to put on the heart of their defense from the first trial, and the brothers were convicted of first-degree murder. As I said, there were 65 defense witnesses in the first trial, people that were eyewitnesses to physical, verbal, and emotional abuse. And from my perspective, that can be just as damaging to a young child as sexual molestation. So the molestation was not my sole criteria for evaluating the case. But I believe the Menendez brothers, not just because they testified that they were molested, but over 30 years, I have spent a lot of time with Jose Menendez's sister and with Kitty Menendez's sister, and everybody in the family knew something was off, something was weird, but Jose was kind of the rich uncle in the family. He loaned your kids, he loaned you money if you needed a loan. He got your kids their first job, so nobody wanted to upset the rich uncle. And also, nobody in the everybody, you know, saw bits and pieces of some strange behavior, but nobody sat the entire family down together in one room until after the brothers were arrested for murder. As I said, I have, you know, in 30 years of reporting, and this is the luxury of a book author, is that you can go so deep into the story and interview hundreds of people, and you're not on a daily deadline, that I feel confident that I really know what happened in this case, and I believe the resolution of the first trial should have been manslaughter, not murder. Half of the jurors, all the women, voted for manslaughter. All the men voted for murder. All the men, I interviewed all the jurors after the first trial. All the men told me a father would never do that to his sons. Now, this was 1994, long before the Me Too, the Men Too movements, long before the Catholic Church abuse. I believe that if the Menendez trial were held today, it would be a completely different outcome. Now I'll answer your question. I'm trying to give a background before we got to this letter. So I'm visiting Marta Cano, my longtime source, going back to September 89 in March of 2018. And we're going, she had told me over the years that she thought that there might be, she might have some letters that Eric Menendez had written to her son when they were 15 and 17. And her son tragically passed away in 2003. He was only, I think around 29 years old. So we started going through his papers that she had never gone through. We found, within an hour, we found a letter, a handwritten letter from Eric Menendez written to Andy Cano. And in the letter, it starts out where Eric is just kind of writing about some routine stuff. And the letter was not in an envelope, so, you know, there's no postmark, you know, that can document specifically when it was written. But the content of the letter authenticates when it was written, because one of the first things Eric writes about is a Christmas party that the family had at the Beverly Hills Mansion for all the employees at Live Entertainment. And he writes details about a giant Christmas tree that his mother bought, and, you know, a ice cream sundae bar that they have the party. And I knew about this party independently. And he also writes about the brothers had just hired a new tennis coach, Mark Heffernan. And I knew independently that had happened in November of 88. So the letter's kind of routinely going along about, you know, kind of routine stuff. And at one point in the letter, Eric writes a paragraph about that he's you know, that his mother is kind of out of it, and he's really worried about her. A few sentences later, I'll read you a a couple sentences that he wrote in which he said, "I've been trying to avoid Dad. It's still happening, Andy, but it's worse for me now. I can't explain it. He's so overweight that I can't stand to see him. I never know when it's going to happen, and it's driving me crazy. Every night I stay up thinking he might come in. I need to put it out of my mind. I know what you said before, but I'm afraid. You just don't know Dad like I do. He's crazy. He's warned me 100 times about telling anyone." So when I hit that point in the letter, I was reading it out loud to Marta Cano, and she became emotional. And I'm like, you know, my jaw has dropped. And within half an hour or 45 minutes, I called the brother's appeal attorney, who's based in Berkeley, and told him about the letter and started reading him some sections. And obviously, he knows the case extremely well because he handled the brother's appeals in state court and in federal court in the Ninth Circuit, and they were turned down on their last appeal in 2005, so that's the end of the road. The only way you can reopen an appeal is if you have new evidence, and, you know, the light bulb went off in my head, well, this is new evidence, and potentially significant new evidence. So that is the general background about this letter, and it is now... I actually hand-carried it from West Palm Beach to Berkeley because I knew it was, you know, of such major significance. I didn't want to send it FedEx and have it get lost. So I hand-carried it to Berkeley. The attorney took possession of it, and he has since, you know, sent it to, you know, the handwriting experts can analyze the ink, can analyze the paper, and I'm told that they can, you know, pinpoint the... you know, within a couple months of when that letter was written.
Well, what do you think the difference it would make if they could prove the sexual assault in a trial? Do you think it would just lighten the sentence?
Well, two things. People that are sexually molesting children typically don't invite, you know, somebody in to watch, or they don't videotape them molesting their, you know, their kid or whoever. So, you know, there will never be, you know, concrete evidence. From my perspective, 30 years of reporting, hundreds of interviews, I was in each 6-month trial every day listening to testimony. There's an overwhelming amount of mitigating evidence that I believe should, you know, that the trial, as I said a moment ago, should have been a manslaughter resolution, not a murder. A manslaughter would have sent them to jail for about 22 to 25 years. They've been in jail for 29 years and about 8 months. The 30-year anniversary of their arrest is coming up in March of March 2020. I hope that they will file a new appeal. As I mentioned, the threshold for filing a new appeal when you've exhausted all your appeals is you have to have new evidence. Now, this letter is potentially a significant piece of new evidence. There is actually additional new evidence. This is the most incredible thing. I am still actively reporting on this case. I am working on a bunch of other things, including a new book unrelated to Menendez. But I am actively doing reporting, and I think he's going to develop some other significant evidence. And so the best outcome, you file an appeal, and you have to show the court that you have new evidence. And the best outcome of that filing is that you're granted a hearing to consider your request for the appeal. And the best outcome, what you're asking for, is you're asking for a court to grant you a new trial. So try to wrap your head around the idea of a third Menendez trial in the social media world of 2020, 2021. OJ was pretty insane, and that was 1995. So just imagine a new Menendez trial. Thanks to NBC and Dick Wolf, they produced an eight-hour limited series called Law & Order True Crime, The Menendez Murders, and that aired in September of 2017, premiered. And it is still streaming on all major platforms. Stars Edie Falco, who was nominated for an Emmy for playing Leslie Abramson, the brother's defense attorney. And so a fascinating thing to me, an entire new generation was introduced to the Menendez brothers case through the NBC series, and every day more people are streaming it and discovering the case. So the interesting thing that happened after the NBC series aired for 8 weeks was that social media just went really crazy and noisy and was totally sympathetic to the brothers, because that was the point of view of the series, and my book, The Menendez Murders, provided the primary source material for the series. And my point of view, as you've been hearing me ramble on for a while since we've been talking today, is that you know, this was a manslaughter, this was not a murder, and that the brothers really were abused, and this mitigating evidence of the family history, you know, should have, you know, was the evidence that should have led to a manslaughter resolution.
But what about the killing of Kitty, their mother? Wouldn't that still be murder? Because the father was abusing, but the mother, you know, I mean, I'm sure she... I guess she knew about it, and that seemed to be the general idea. But to actually kill her, wouldn't that be still murder?
That's a great question. The number one question people ask me is, Eric and Lyle Menendez were 18 and 21 years old. Why didn't they just walk out the front door? And that's easy to say if you're thinking of them through the perspective of a normal 18 or 21-year-old. But the therapy experts, the defense therapists that evaluated them, told me that their emotional maturity was somewhere between 8 and 10 years old. They couldn't imagine life without their parents. So even though a normal person, you know, it's easy to, you know, just, you know, logically say, well, they would just walk out the door. The brothers couldn't imagine walking out the door. The second question that people ask me the most is, okay, I might be willing to accept that Jose Menendez was a monster, but what about their mother? You know, Kitty Menendez was a mother, and we all, you know, believe the, you know, the general stereotypes that mothers are supposed to be nurturing and caring and loving, and unfortunately, not all mothers are. Kitty Menendez was an alcoholic. She had issues with prescription pills. And the brothers testified that there were a series of confrontations in the days before the murders. And in one of them, Kitty Menendez told the brothers, you know, they were talking to her, you know, about the abuse. And she said, I've known, according to their testimony, she said, I've known all along. Do you think I'm stupid? And, that was, you know, that was a crushing piece of information for the brothers, the idea that that their mother knew and didn't do anything to protect them. So, of course, Kitty Menendez didn't deserve to die, and neither did Jose Menendez. And as I said a few moments ago, nothing gives you a free pass to kill mom and dad. But these were two dysfunctional parents, and they raised two troubled sons, and everything ended in this terrible tragedy. And in the second trial, one of the major differences from the first trial was at the last moment, at the very end of the trial, before it went to the jury, before the case went to the jury, the judge changed his instructions to the jury, and he would not allow the defense attorneys to argue that the murder of Kitty Menendez was a manslaughter. The judge said there was, and Lyle Menendez didn't testify at the second trial. Eric Menendez tried to carry the ball for both brothers. And so the judge said, I'm not going to let you, you know, argue manslaughter for Kitty Menendez because I haven't heard any evidence about Kitty Menendez. So there, and the defense made the mistake of assuming that, you know, he had allowed them to use this imperfect self-defense instruction on Kitty Menendez in the first trial. They assumed that they were going to be able to do that in the second trial. And that was a really critical, you know, kind of death blow for the defense, that, you know, they were, you know, surprised by, caught off guard. So that was a key factor in the brothers being convicted in the second trial. And then after they were convicted of first-degree murder in March of 96, there was a second segment of the trial called the penalty phase, in which the jury had to decide between the death penalty or life without parole. And during that three-week penalty phase, the jurors heard all of that family history that the judge had kept out most of it in the second trial, the family history that was the heart of the defense in the first trial. So the jurors voted for life without parole after 3 weeks. I interviewed all the jurors, and three or four of them told me after the second trial, if they had heard that family history in the guilt phase, they would not have voted for murder. So some people have said, there's the fix. And in the final brothers' appeal in front of the Ninth Circuit in 2005, one of the justices, Alex Kaczynski, actually said in the hearing, I have an audio tape of it, and he said that he believed there had been collusion between the L.A. County DA's office and Judge Stanley Weisberg to convict the Menendez brothers in the second trial. But even though he said that, Justice Kaczynski still voted against the appeal. But anyway, it's a really interesting case.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And now, do you have a website that people can come and find you on and pass on information?
I do. It is easy to remember, MenendezMurders.com.
Wow.
Wow. That's it. Well, we're going to have posted along with your book, The Menendez Murders. Thank you for talking with us about your book and about the research in the case.
Guys, Robert, thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks, Robert. It was fantastic.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll say it.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.